Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. It's great to have Leonard M. Harlan here, who I will introduce briefly, who is chairman of Castle Harlan. He's also the co-founder of Castle Harlan, which is a corporate buyout business, which has been very successful in the United States, and as I understand it, has created 250 millionaires, which is quite an achievement. Now, I should also say I'm grateful to Janet Holmes in Court, who's one of our members, who advised us that Mr. Harlan would be in Australia today. He's been involved since 2000 in the CHAMP private equity business, which stands for Castle Harlan Australia Mezzanine Partners, and works with that. But he also owns an apartment in Potts Point and is a regular visitor to Sydney in particular and to Australia more generally. So it's great to have Leonard M. Harlan along tonight. And the topic for tonight's talk is America Today, the Good News. Mr. Harlan, you're very welcome.
Well, first, I'm very honored to be here. And I'm just a little overwhelmed by the sellout crowd, so thank you for coming. My mother must have sent you a memo, I guess. That's really appreciated. Today, I decided everybody knows about the election, and there are lots of pundits who can talk about it far better than I can. So I'm not here to talk about the election. I'm not here to tell you what is wrong. You've heard enough, and you'll hear a lot more in the coming days and weeks. But what I'd like to do is to tell you about things that perhaps are maybe new or you really already know, but I'll try to put it together as to why I'm very enthusiastic about the United States at this point in time. First, some basics. Unemployment is stabilized. It's slowly going down. That's very, very significant. Very significant. Jobs are being created. 32 months of consecutive growth in the private sector. 32 months of growth. The private sector is alive and well in the United States. Labor productivity, a very, very important element of the economy, keeps increasing, and very significantly. And I've got some charts here to show you, but it's been unbelievable right through the GFC. Productivity going up. And most importantly for all of us in this room, the love affair between the American people and the Australians remains not just intact, but is as strong as ever. And it's really very special. And I can tell you, as an American, been coming here since the late 90s, there's just this marvelous affinity. And I think many of you who've traveled in the United States have felt that as well. I don't know of any two countries that I'm starting to laugh because I'm thinking Canadians don't get that reception. But really, the good news is what's going on in the U.S. today, and that's really what I want to talk about. I think to do that, I want to just cover some basic observations. We're a country of immigrants. The people who founded the United States and the waves of immigration that have come to the United States have all been waves of people escaping some form of oppression. Largely government oppression. And that sets the stage for a whole society which has no top to it. Anybody can make it to the top. There's no aristocracy in the United States. There's no preconceived notion that you can't do it, and that anyone can make it to the top. Upward mobility is a cornerstone in our society. It also is in reverse, because those who've been at the top, if they don't maintain within the family or what or the entities, they drop out as well. So it goes both ways. And it is really a frontier society. A frontier society with optimism. And that optimism is ingrained in our people. You know, there's that attitude that we can make it happen. Just try. And in fact, I remember as a youngster in grammar school, my teacher said to me, American is spelled A-M-E-R, I can, I-C-A-N. All right? And I remember it like it was yesterday. So self-reliance, hard work, little fear of failure. Failure is accepted and celebrated. That's a very, very key item in our society. And just think about it. I mean, I can take one of the most glaring examples. Steve Jobs. He was fired. I mean, humiliated. Comes back, and look what he does. And we can talk about lots of different folks, but the fact is that failure, in many cases, in most cases, is celebrated. So there's no attitude, you didn't make it, kid. It's what did you learn from that experience, which again goes to that optimistic, what can we do better, which is ingrained in our society. There's a strong sense of community, idealism. You see it in philanthropy. You see it in aid. You see it in American naivete. And I think if anybody really is honest about it, Americans can be very naive, particularly in the international sphere. We may be very trusting, sometimes too trusting. But that's built into our system. Think about it. The Puritans came, all right, they settled. They had to rely on themselves, create their own structure, and move on from there. So what adds to that is that each wave of immigrants has risen to the top, and that really gives an extra boost to those who've been there for here in the United States for a while. And it's so interesting to see. I mean, when the Vietnamese came in, a boost, all right? And various ethnic groups came in, a boost. And that kickstarts, and it gets everybody's juices going, because there's also that natural competitive juice, if you will, in the community. So what we have here is caring, naive, generous. And these attributes are as strong today as they were 100 to 200 years ago. So that's the backdrop to where we are and can go as a society, and what it means, hopefully, to the United States. And if it works in the United States, the spillover can be enormous around the globe. So let's talk about the economy for a moment in more particular ways. Manufacturing is coming back to the United States. Let me give you one very specific example. Mercedes-Benz. They have a plant in South Carolina, and that plant produces their SUVs, and that plant now is producing all the SUVs for Mercedes worldwide. In other words, they are exporting the SUVs from South Carolina. We owned a company called Ames True Temper. We manufactured shovels and rakes and all kinds of hand things, and we had shifted a lot of our production to China. We built a new plant in Pennsylvania, and we brought half of that production back. Very significant. Worker productivity continues to improve, as I said, and that fits with that model. Industrial union membership is the lowest since World War II. That's pretty significant. So when you see union membership, that's all been, the growth of that has all been in the public sector. And maybe in Q&A we can talk a little bit about that, but that's where it is. But in the industrial sector, it's been dropping year after year after year. And why is that? Because we have enlightened management, and that enlightened management manifests itself in tremendous ways, and we'll talk more in a minute or two about that. But not insignificantly, I might add, the glass ceiling for women is gone. I don't know whether you saw it in the papers, but this weekend, Lockheed announced. Lockheed, defense industry, old boy network, a woman has just been made CEO. All right? Nestle, Kraft, eBay, HP, I could go on, Xerox, I could go on. They're all led by women. All right? That's very important. Very important. So it's a community that's now, more than ever, a meritocracy. If you're good, you can get there. And everybody wants you to win. That's the other part of it. People want you to win. And what's very important and built into this system is that Johnny Lunchbucket says, I want that top open so my kids can be there too. And that's been the tradition. So waves of immigrants and others have all felt that my kid could get there. Now, this doesn't mean to say that we haven't had our problems going back over time, but I'm talking about right now. That creates a society that drives hard. And as a result, and you will see it with the results of this election, people will pull together because Americans say, okay, if that's the decision, that's the decision. And for the most part, the vast majority of Americans will just say, okay, we're Americans and we're going to go get the job done. We got 4 years and then we'll see what happens. That's very, very important. The consumer sentiment is rising today. All the polls have forgotten to look at consumer sentiment. Consumer sentiment, very important, very high and rising. And cash is in the system. Unlike before the GFC, the banks are loaded with cash, corporations are loaded with cash, individuals are loaded with cash. So cash is not an issue, which is very, very important in terms of the ability to move out and move on. But most important is cheap energy. I just pulled this up. A friend of mine just sent this to me. In this morning's New York Times, one of the lead stories is the U.S. to be the world's top oil producer in 5 years. It will overtake Saudi Arabia to become the world's leading producer by 2017 and will be a net oil producer. Now, we're not talking about natural gas now. Oil. A net oil producer by 2030. And this is a report by the International Energy Agency. Now, think of that. The foundation of any industrial society is energy. And we are moving in the direction of the cheapest energy out there. And look at the implications of that for our industrial growth and our ability to be, once again, a manufacturing country, because we never had the heart eaten out of manufacturing, despite what the newspapers would like to suggest. But it's coming back and it's building. And that's very significant. In addition to that, technology and innovation is on the rise, which has really been the backbone of what's been occurring over the last 20 years. And as I said before, we're a country where new business failure is acceptable. So let's look at new enterprise and innovation. Startups, all right, startups. In the United States in 08 and 09, the GFC, 3 million new jobs were created by startup corporations in the United States. Right. How's that to counter all of this gloom and doom that people think about in terms of the GFC in the United States and what happened? And those startups, just remember, Microsoft was a startup at one time. Hewlett-Packard started in the Great Depression in the garage of the two founders, right? We have an environment in California and in New York that is just truly extraordinary. And what is that environment in terms of startups? We have technical universities. We have research dollars. We have ideas, and we have the availability of capital, and this is very, very important. Angel capital, growth capital, venture capital. And to give you a statistic there, 70% of all the venture capital in the globe in 2011 was in the United States, $50 billion, right? Now, what does this mean? Think about it this way. A person can come up with an idea, all right, and say, I'm going to take a risk. I'm going to build something. And if they need capital, they just shout down the street, and the neighbors and friends, 5,000 here, 10,000 there, and before you know it, you've got $100,000, and you're in business. And then the next stage is the real professional angels who then can give the next 200,000 and so on and so forth. And you've got a banking system in the United States that says we will bet on ideas. There's a bank called Silicon Valley Bank. It's one of the fastest growing banks in the United States. It's now moving worldwide. It started in Silicon Valley. And how did it start? It took a risk with these little companies, many of which did not have any revenues, but they had backers. And they didn't go to the backers and say, we want you to guarantee it. They knew the backers because it was the old concept of banking. Credit, and credit is defined as knowing who you are lending to. And their character, the second C, is key. All right? So it's none of this asset business. What it is really taking a look. So Silicon Valley Bank would lend to these companies. Kleiner Perkins, one of the great venture capital firms, would finance a company, and then they needed some working capital. What would they do? They'd go to Silicon Valley Bank, and they would lend on the basis that Kleiner Perkins, they're not going to let this company go under. But they didn't have to guarantee it. They just knew. They knew. That's a pretty good environment to build on. I'll give you a counterexample. You'll love this one. This is an example. I have a younger son who is in the apps business, building applications for the iPad, the iPhone, Android, whatever. He and his partner, my son had spent his third year in college at University of Melbourne, Trinity College, and his best friend from there, the two of them decided in New York that they were going to build this business 2 years ago. It was the two of them. Today they have 31 people in the shop. Right? Catch of the Day is one of their apps. The Qantas Frequent Flyer is one of their apps. I could just go on. As well as in the States, Sesame Street, Coca-Cola, you get it. Okay. 6 months ago, are you ready for this? 6 months ago, and by the way, it's still run out of New York, but down here in Melbourne are at this point 26 of their people because they can't hire the talent in New York right now. It's just too expensive and not enough of it, interesting enough. There's a real shortage. Melbourne, absolutely outstanding. All right? So 6 months ago, they needed a business MasterCard or Visa. They didn't care. One or the other. They went to three different pillar banks. Each one said, we would be glad. How much credit do you want on the card? Oh, maybe $15,000, $20,000. That's all we need. We just need it to make our purchases. The bank said, we'd be delighted to, if you'll put up a CD for the whole amount. And if you can't put up a CD, why didn't one of you, if you have the net worth, guarantee it? Right? Sad. In the States, if you're graduating college, you get credit cards in the mail with $10,000 worth of credit. Right? In other words, it's the orientation towards risk. It's the orientation towards success. It's the orientation towards optimism. And I think that is really, it's just great. And that's what we're dealing with in the United States, is that environment. And it is a very, very exciting environment. Now, I should also tell you that there has been a tremendous growth in government research, which is another foundation of our society, because, as many of you may recall, NASA and all of its expenditures had lots of spin-offs of all kinds of things that we use today, all early electronics and such. And it all came from the government investing. But what distinguishes government investment is the fact that, well, let's just take, for instance, NIH. If they, National Institutes of Health, if they give a research grant to a university and the university comes up with an invention, the university owns it. The government has declared it wants no rights to it. It is owned by the university and whoever invented it. They worked that out. All right? Again, to encourage new and exciting inventions and creations. So I have a couple of statistics, because this just is really interesting. I just found it great. Let's take total non-defense investment in research and development. In 2002, total non-defense, so we're not talking about any of that other stuff, it was $39.7 billion. In 2013, the fiscal year which ends in June, it will have grown from 39.6 to 61.6. All right? Now, we hear all this stuff about Medicare and its growth and all of that. But what is growing, which I frankly feel has to be protected, is this. And what makes that really, really significant is that in the GFC, 2008, remember my base is 39.6, it was up to 55, then the next year it was 57, then went to 59. You get the trend? What does that mean for our society? It means rebirth, growth, development. It's all built into the system. That, to me, is very exciting. So let me give you an example, a very tangible example. What it is the Cornell, excuse me, what it is the Cornell University Tech Campus in New York City. Now this is really, really exciting. What that means, what that is that Mayor Bloomberg had a concept. And that was to leave a legacy for generations to come. New York has become known as Silicon Alley, in contrast to Silicon Valley. But it's been a poor cousin. As I mentioned by way of example of my own son's company, there's been a shortage of skilled technical professionals. So what Bloomberg did with his administration this past year is they created a new concept and design, a new campus. Strictly graduate students. These students would spawn new companies, like in Silicon Valley, and with Stanford, and Israel with Technion, just using those two as benchmarks. All right? And they put out a request for proposal to institutions all over the world. The incentives were that they would take the lower third of Roosevelt Island, which is in the East River, and give it to the institution. And in addition to that, the city would give $100 million to the creation of this tech campus. The finalists, and they had submissions from all over the world, were Stanford, in collaboration or joint venture with City University, and Weill Cornell, the engineering campus in Ithaca, New York, in joint venture with Technion. Now, Cornell won. And this really, I'm a Cornell engineer by training, by education. Cornell won. They have a benefactor who stepped up to the line and said, I will give you $350 million to build this campus. Some of you may know the name Chuck Feeney. Chuck Feeney was a Cornell graduate. He's been very generous to Cornell as well as many institutions, including institutions here in Australia. In addition to that, the board of trustees of Cornell said, we will set aside $150 million of our endowment for venture capital so that this will be an incubator of new ideas and new companies. And we will provide the fuel necessary. And that's key. For a society to really expand in today's world, you need legitimate fuel, energy, but you also need financial fuel. And with the right attitude. So there will be a campus, because Cornell won, Stanford stepped back. There will be a campus with 2 million square feet of applied science and engineering. They expect, when they reach a Statius Point, which should be in about 5 years, to be graduating. It's only graduates now, it's not undergraduates. They expect to be graduating a minimum of 2,000 students a year, which will equal the engineering graduate school in Ithaca. They're starting right now. Google has given them 2 floors in their office building, in their building in New York. And the first class, the entering class, is being assembled right now of only 20 students as they debug this program. And they will start in January. Mind you, this award was made in March. Look how fast that's going. It's phenomenal. There'll be incubators. There'll be new businesses. What this does to the city of New York is amazing, because you'll have all parts of Long Island City and Brooklyn and whatever, which will become homes for new companies that we can't even imagine. They've created an advisory board. Bloomberg is the chairman. Eric Schmidt, who founded Google, is his right-hand person. And his other right-hand person is Irwin Jacobs, who founded Qualcomm. Irwin Jacobs is a Cornell graduate. Now, what distinguished this was the university let it be known to everybody in the university community, I'm talking about Cornell now, what they were trying to do. And people just grabbed on. The students wrote petitions and did all kinds of things to demonstrate that this new campus had the entire community behind it, from graduates to faculty to students. That's the energy. that I'm talking about. That's part of the good news that I really want to leave you with. There'll be new teaching models. You'll see new ways of teaching. For instance, they will have, each student will have a business mentor coming from the New York community, and they will have a 3-hour class, that is 3-credit-hour class each semester, surrounding working with that mentor. In other words, these are to be people who aren't going to be intellectual elite. These are people who are going to get it done and make it happen. And they're incorporated into this a healthier life hub, which means the Weill Cornell Medical School will also be related, which, by the way, relates to the engineering school in Ithaca, which has one of the finest nanotech centers in the country. And new discoveries, new technologies, and New York will become a major high-tech center in the United States and, for that matter, in the world. What a legacy. And takes leadership of the kind that Bloomberg has here. And it is, I guess you can tell I'm excited. Now, another part of this whole picture is philanthropy. Philanthropy is embedded in our society, as you know. Now, what do we mean? Well, we have today the concept of giving back, and it is extraordinary. Of those people who have $1 million net worth or more, over 5% of their income, according to the statistics, is given back in philanthropy. I might add, by the way, in Australia it's less than 2%. Right? And what it means is that in many communities your social acceptance is a function of what you're giving back. An interesting way of defining the top. And as a result, there are marvelous examples. You all probably have heard of John Paulson, the money manager who made this fortune in the financial crisis. What you may or may not know is that not very long ago he gave $100 million to Central Park. There's a Central Park Conservancy, interested, devoted community people who've restored Central Park. And if you haven't been to Central Park recently, just go. You will not believe how beautiful it is. He's given them $100 million to further the restoration. Steve Schwartzman gave $100 million to the New York Public Library. What you probably don't know is the New York Public Library doesn't get any financial support from the city. Right? It's all through donations, endowments, and people like Steve Schwartzman. But it's not just the money, it's volunteerism, which is another part of our society. And that volunteerism kind of binds the cheese in many ways. So we have, as I mentioned, Central Park Conservancy. I'll just give you two personal examples, but it's great fun. After Perestroika, the U.S. Congress set up the SEED Act, and the SEED Act said that we will take funds and devoted to the privatization of former Soviet Union satellites and other parts of Eastern Europe. And we'll set these up as funds. And then they came to Wall Street and asked people, Wall Streeters, if they would donate their time and become directors of each of these funds, with the idea that they were giving back in the sense of their time and their expertise. The smallest of these is the Bulgarian American Enterprise Fund, $58 million. And in 15 years, we grew that to $500 million, pioneered the banking industry. We privatized what has now become the largest chicken slaughtering operation, and lots of things. Then we declared victory
Because our goal wasn't to be in the business of financing companies. It was to do what we just did. We declared victory. We converted it all into cash. And we got Congress to agree with us that we could take 400 of it and establish a foundation for the betterment of Bulgarian-American relations. And so we finance, with our grants, things like agricultural people from the outlying community to come to the United States to learn new techniques, given the future shortage in the world food supply. We finance cultural exchanges. So we have film festivals. And you can just use your imagination. We're also working on the serious problem of the Roma, which is the gypsies. Here again, it's an example of American idealism where we did something practical and then convert it to something which hopefully will leave a lasting impression and the foundation will be there for a long time. Another example is BENS, which you most likely also haven't heard of, which is Business Executives for National Security. And there are about 600 or 700 of us around the country, very quietly. We work with the national security interests in trying to help them become more effective in their jobs. And this from money tracing in the early days when we had all kinds of illicit funds going back and forth to, if you name it, it's there. But it also means that American business people are relating to the colonels and the generals and whatever, and there is that level of realism that gets established. So we don't any longer have a volunteer army or volunteer armed services, but with groups like this, there becomes a balance. So it's not the money. It's not the money at all. I'll give you another couple of illustrations which goes to education. Again, New York City. Education is getting better, despite what you're reading in the newspaper. And we have in New York two groups involved with. One is called Principal for a Day. And what that is we have 1,000 people who are community leaders, business people primarily, who one day a year go out and work with a principal or a superintendent out there in the trenches to understand the issues with the hope and expectation that that business will adopt that school so that there is a relationship. Because I can tell you from firsthand experience, it's not the money, it's that somebody cares. All right? These kids need to feel somebody cares. And what we do in our firm is we bring in kids from this program after school who've never been to Manhattan. We teach them how to dress, how to conduct themselves. They work in the mailroom or whatever, and on holidays. And it's a win-win situation. There's another group we're involved with called Chess in the Schools. Very interesting program. Because when you take little kids from the third grade who have all kinds of energy and they can't sit still, and you get them to focus on learning chess, and chess is a metaphor for life, and you get these kids, and we have 34,000 kids playing chess in New York City. In the school system. When you get these kids playing chess, they're thinking about strategy, they're listening because they have to keep quiet, and they're developing their learning skills. And as evidence of the interest in all of this, we have Teach for America, which you probably have heard of. And you know, there are more kids who apply to Teach for America who graduate undergraduate school in the United States than any other program in the United States. And at this point, Teach for America can't find enough school systems to put these bright young people who want to volunteer to teach in the schools for 2 or 3 years. Well, we also have the generosity of people. And an example, and we're shifting what's going on in education. We're shifting to the whole concept of incentive bonuses. In other words, it's not money again. In this case, it's the teacher and it's the manager or administrator of the school. And we're seeing progress. And at the federal level, there's a race to the top by the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, which got the states to compete with each other. Americans are competitive. They love it. You know, the juices just rise and at all aspects. And so states competed for money. And that money was to go, they competed on the basis of new programs and rising scores, test scores, to move the dial for these young people. We have also the advent of charter schools, which are sponsored and paid for in large measure by business people and businesses, and this too becomes an alternative educational source. And then we have other school models, management training, and bonuses for performance, which I mentioned, and Zuckerberg, Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook fame, or shall I say the movie, Mark Zuckerberg has given $100 million to the city of Newark, New Jersey to develop a bonus program for their teachers. And there's no more difficult city to operate in than Newark. So the American people are not turning their back on this particular issue. And also what's happening is community colleges are being converted, in many cases, to vocational schools. Because what we did is we got ourselves all excited about everybody should go to college, and who's there to repair the automobile, who's there to, you know, do the electrical work, the plumbing work, and all of this. And now we're coming back and facing that, and the community colleges increasingly will be there to fill that gap. So, as I said, it's not the money, it's the program, and it's the teacher. And I don't know if any of you have ever seen the movie Waiting for Superman. It's a great movie, it's a documentary, and it talks about the whole education issue in the States and what can be done. Let me kind of pull this together a little bit. Okay. Wow. I'm sorry. I am talky. I'll try to pull this together very quickly here with Weill Cornell Medical School, which is, its mission is to teach, train interns, residents, clinical practice, patients, research, but translational medicine, and an attitude, which is an attitude here too, but does not exist in some other countries. An attitude that if you're sick, the doctor will find a way, someplace in the world, to get you cured. That, again, that very positive attitude. But what I want to point out is that in the 16 years since 1996, Weill Cornell Medical School raised from the private sector $2.25 billion, right? And where this is going is to build new buildings, bring in new professors, provide subsidies for students. It's the whole gamut, and I won't go into the detail. But the point I want to get to is the capital that gets raised because of commitment is extremely important. And Cornell, Weill Cornell Medical School, gets no money from any government agency except through NIH research grants, which are competitive grants. All right? Remember the foundation I tried to build on, the self-reliance, It all goes back to that. Annual philanthropy, $34 million this last year, largely from grateful patients. The endowment alone for this school is $1 billion, which generates about $46 million of income. And I won't bore you with a lot of the other, but I will just say that NIH research, which has really been very important for American medicine by the government, it moved from 02 of $21 billion to $32 billion in 2013. And I should also point out that despite the fact that we have shifted our medical paradigm or business model, medical school applications are up. And at Cornell, we had almost 60 applicants for every seat. And 50% of them, 50% of them are women. Very, very, very profound. And the growth in medical schools is lagging. In the last 10 years, they've grown only 10% from 125 to 137, while the growth in student applications has grown from 34,000 to 44,000. What's really interesting is the medical school, the number of seats are 19,000 seats. For law school, there are 50,000 seats. I think we got it backwards, but that's a whole other thing. So in conclusion, why am I optimistic? I'm optimistic because of the founding culture that I started with. That sense of optimism for the future, innovative, the sense of social justice, the idea of giving back, and not insignificant is this energy independence. And more importantly, we remain a very patriotic community, supportive of each other, and we've never been a colonial power. We've gone in, we've ultimately gone out. It's taken us some time sometimes. But the point is that we really want to do the right thing. And I'm very proud of America, and I'm very bullish on America, and I hope you're bullish too. Thank you.
So, many thanks. So we come to questions and discussion. Before we do, I should thank Clayton Yurtz for the use of this fine facility this evening. And so we go to questions and discussion. Just starting off, just we'll be fairly brief with a lot of people here. We've got till the top of the hour. You spoke very much about New York, about what's happening with education and whatever else. Out of the election, there was a lot of news about Latinos. You spend a lot of time in Florida. Some feeling that some of them don't feel connected anymore to the Republican Party. I mean, how do you see that other side of immigrants and the descendants of immigrants, some lawful, some not lawful, predominantly in the southern states of America? How are they getting on? Are they sort of fulfilling this American dream, or feel they're fulfilling this American dream that you've referred to?
Well, if you want to look at that, look at Miami. I mean, you see a dynamic city. It's referred to by many people as the capital of South America. It's extraordinary. Those who've come, and many of them happen to be Cuban, however, or Colombian, those who have come have felt that opportunity and have taken advantage of it. I don't want to get into the Republicans and what they should have done or should not have done, but clearly they are Americans, and they're enjoying, as they should, the opportunities that America represents. And I think you see that around the country. Candidates, we could spend a whole night talking about the candidates and what they should have done or shouldn't have done with respect to various minority groups, but that's my thought.
Right up the back, yeah. Just stay here in front of the mic.
Sure.
It's happening all over the Western world, and the culture of America's enterprising spirit and all of that is very familiar to us in terms of theory. But there's also now developing a sense of entitlement. This is what people are talking about. And with the so-called fiscal cliff and all the discussions about what will be cut and so on, Is there developing in America, as there has been in Europe, this notion of entitlement, and how is America going to keep that enterprising spirit going when there are so many people with dependence of some kind on government?
Well, I share the concern. I personally believe that we should have compulsory elections like you have here, because we could get away from some of the distortions that the entitlements are creating in our system. And that's really unfortunate. It is a serious dilemma. On the other hand, I should tell you that, remember I pointed out that there's 32 months of consecutive employment in the private sector. At the same time, the public sector was going the other way. All right? Those were some of those entitlement folks. So it's being addressed not as frontally as maybe some of us would like to see, but it is being addressed. And so the employment rolls are happening. And I will say to you that there is a major crisis coming that doesn't get talked about, and that is the crisis of the cities, towns, and states, and they're having excessive borrowings, and they can't get out of that problem the way the federal government can by printing money. So keep your eye on that one. That's one, and we've already seen several cities, Stockton, California being one of them, that have declared bankruptcy, and I think the Water Authority or something in Birmingham, Alabama, and there's some others. That's a critical one. Where we are having our problems is we've politicized things that are community services to such a degree that we're not necessarily instituting sound business principles. And that's where business has to step up stronger and speak out on these issues.
There are two in the middle there. Here we go, here first and then there. Yep. Yes, you.
Mr. Harland, you said that companies and consumers are flush with cash, implying that there's a need for incentives for productivity to increase the potential growth. My question is that what is the prospect of lower personal income tax rates or streamlining the regulations like Frank Dodd in the next Obama administration to increase the potential growth?
Well, let me address it in a couple of ways, because unfortunately the Dodd-Frank bill increased regulations dramatically. It didn't simplify. I'll just give you one example. For the whole issue of political contributions is written up in 200 pages, the regulations, just political contributions. So it's gone the other way. Now, in terms of dealing with the issue of regulation and simplification and the fact that there's cash, you can't drive down a road if you don't know where the road is going. And the problem that the business community has had is that the regulators have had a certain tyranny. And I have a statistic on the number of the increase in regulations that have occurred, and it's appalling. I'll find it in a minute or two. But the point is, regulations have increased dramatically, and what happens is when that, and you don't know where they're going, you can't plan your business because you need a model that you can count on in order to plan your business. It's just like international diplomacy. You need to know the rules of the game that you can count on in order to move through whatever it is you want to go to. So that's the reason, to me, the major reason why business has all this cash. They're investing in productivity, but that's different than in expansion of plant.
There's a question in the middle there, and then we go to John. Yeah, yes.
Mr. Harland, you commented that the learning from failure has been one of the fundamental characteristics of the U.S. culture. What lessons do you think the country has learned from the failures that led to the GFC?
I think that's a great question, and I think it's a central question. I think the biggest lesson that we've learned is you can't over-leverage tomorrow. And if you looked at our system, consumers were over-leveraged, their housing was over-leveraged, businesses were, the government was over-leveraged, all right? And what we really have been going through significantly is deleveraging all aspects of our society. And I think that's the big lesson. There are other subsidiary lessons, but I'm just taking the big one. And there are a number of other lessons, such as if you have rules on the books, make sure that they are enforced. And I'll give you a very simple example of that. There's a rule, when Bear Stearns went down and Lehman Brothers was going down and there was just chaos on Wall Street, this was either precipitated or exacerbated by short selling of their stock. And then people were losing confidence. Now, not that many years ago, there was a rule on the books that said you cannot sell short without either owning the stock or borrowing the stock certificates from somebody else so that you had possession of it. So when it was needed, it was there. What happened was the SEC chose, for whatever reason, to ignore that, and people were selling short what we call naked. And so they could just sell short. Then the SEC also, instead of ignoring, they chose to actually get rid of another regulation, which was that you could only sell short if the stock went up. In other words, an uptick. And if there was an uptick, you could sell. And the purpose of that was to break the momentum. Well, they chose to get rid of that for whatever reason, I don't know. And so you could get this piling on and piling on, all right? The rules are there. You didn't need Dodd-Frank to come back and deal with the wrong issues. And I also believe, personally, I don't believe that we should have too big to fail as one of our bases for the financial system. The banks should fail just like anybody else. And what's happened is, and this is sad, the regulations are now favoring the big banks because the little banks have the cost of regulating for the little banks is so enormous. So we may get more concentration out of this when in fact for the good of the country we need less concentration.
Two very quick questions. It's got to be very quick. Hillary and then John. Sorry that we're just running out of
time. I was just interested in from the beginning of your talk. You said that in 5 years' time, the United States, I think, would be the greatest producer of cheap oil. And I just wondered, you said no fracking. Where'd that come from?
No, I didn't say no fracking. No. I said no natural gas. In other words, I was just talking about oil, not natural gas. Natural gas already, we're awash with it.
So where's the oil coming from, right?
Yeah, the oil is coming from fracking, and it's also coming from oil sands, and it's coming from new wells.
So that'll include Canada as well, will it?
Yes, but this article is saying the U.S., but it's North America.
North America. Yeah. Okay, John.
Lynn, I was thinking when you were describing the Bloomberg Cornell campus that it's great shape I don't have the California or the Palo Alto climate.
or the Sydney climate.
The question, someone mentioned the fiscal cliff. Do you think it will be possible for the Congress to work out some sort of a sensible compromise when the time comes?
Yes, I do. I think that there are always going to be a few people who are going to be out there in la-la land, and that's on both sides of the aisle. But I think fundamentally people will move to the center. The United States is fundamentally a centrist country. And Clinton demonstrated that very successfully when he ran the second time. And I think we're going to see some evidence of that. It's going to take some real tough slugging. Mm-hmm. And my guess is that they're going to kick the can down the road for 6 months or so to give themselves time to get it together. But I do think that fundamentally, and Bonner, I think, correctly stated that we're in the game with you, and the president has said we're in the game with you, and let's see what happens.
Can I take one very quick question?
May I ask a question on foreign policy?
Yes.
What do you think were the drivers of America's or Obama's foreign policy decisions about Iran in the first term, and do you think that will change at all during the second term?
Oh, boy. I just don't know. I mean, I'm out of my depths. I could give you my opinions, but that's all they would... I mean, I feel more comfortable talking about the other items. I do feel... Iran, and I think most Americans, particularly on the East Coast, feel very, very, very concerned about Iran. Very concerned about the fact that we have lost our position as being a big brother to many folks for stability. I think the Benghazi affair is going to rear its head in some very ugly ways. I hope not, but I'm concerned. So, I don't know.
It's a fine conclusion. An honest conclusion.
Thank you. Yes, thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, I think we gathered from the response to the last question that our speaker is a realist and he talks about what can be talked about, and so his optimism should be measured in that regard. It's an optimism based on facts and assessment and evidence, and we've heard that tonight. Look, I'll be very brief because we're right on 7 o'clock. I'm very grateful that you could come.
Thank you.
I know you visit Australia regularly and we'll have you back again. You're most welcome with your insights and some very important insights tonight about a side of the United States that we don't often hear about, in particularly philanthropy and related matters and education and research and American innovation. And I think it's true to say that a society as innovative as the United States is not going to stay off the top of the pace for long, and I'm sure what you're saying tonight will be proved correct in time, and we look forward to a further analysis from you on that. But for tonight, thank you and well done.
Yes, thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.